So that's Matthew chapter 5, starting from verse 1. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied."
Ellie, thanks very much indeed for reading. Let me add my welcome to Tom's this morning. It's really nice of us to welcome you to St. Nick's Church. Thank you. I know we've got a number of people here for the first time. Particular welcome to you. My name is Chris, part of the leadership team. And so it's great to be starting this new series with you today. We're in the Sermon on the Mount. And I guess the Sermon on the Mount is probably the most famous sermon ever given. It's one of those sort of things that we've often heard referred to or quoted perhaps in various contexts. So we're going to spend most of this term really focusing on the Sermon on the Mount and going through it in manageable chunks, I hope. And I hope that'll be true today. Picture the crowds gathered at Jesus. I mean, it must have been a very sort of anticipated moment as these crowds, they'd heard obviously enough about Jesus to warrant them coming together and gathering and meeting him that day on the mountain. One commentator puts it like this: with beautiful simplicity, using terms any age could understand, Jesus brought blessing rather than condemnation. Having endured a lifetime of verbal assaults by scribes and Pharisees, the multitude on the mount must have thought they had died and gone to heaven. That's the impression that's given as Jesus gathers this group together. Here is a refreshing sermon that Jesus delivers in huge contrast to anything else that was going on. Well, I hope this morning, just to sort of whet our appetites a little bit and give us a desire, a hunger to sort of want to learn more and to really want to sort of dive into this sermon and spend time thinking about it, applying it to our lives. Let me take you straight to the key verse of where we're going to land in our time today. Have a look at verse 6. It was the last verse that was read out just now. So chapter 5, verse 6. "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." They shall be content, lacking nothing. To hunger and thirst means to greatly desire. More than anything, Jesus says, more than anything in this world, we should greatly desire righteousness. It should be, in other words, the heartbeat of our life, the attribute above all other attribute that characterizes you, says Jesus, should be your desire, your hunger and thirst for righteousness. So right at the start, I mean, it's worth just a moment of deep personal reflection, isn't it? Here's some thoughts that can start to go through your head. I mean, put aside just for a moment what you say you believe. You might say you're a Christian, you might say you're looking into things, but put all of that to one side. Put to one side the fact that you attend church today or perhaps regularly. Put to one side the fact that you have Christian friends. For some people here, put to one side the fact that you're on the regular sort of service rota or serve as a small group leader here or something like that. What is it, having put all those things to one side, what is it that means more to you than anything else in this world? What is the one must-have? I must have this above all else. What drives your ambition, consumes your thoughts? You know, when you sort of get disturbed in the middle of the day as something comes into your mind, what is the sort of the default thought that disturbs you? What distracts? What directs your impulses? You can see where Jesus is going with this. Jesus is saying, make that thing, the desire to be righteous, to have a right standing before the God who made you, make that the thing that properly distracts you. That's the key to life. Socrates, the Greek philosopher, he tells a story of a young man that runs up to him one day and says, you know, great Socrates, I want knowledge. I want knowledge more than anything. And so the story goes, Socrates took him down to a river. And this man was just asking him a simple question. And no sooner had he taken on board what was going on that Socrates sort of took hold of him by the scruff and pushed him under the water. And the man sort of struggled a bit. And Socrates held him under the water in this river. And I don't know how long for, but enough to make the man squirm and fight a lot. And just when he was sort of, you know, beginning to get a bit frantic, Socrates pulled him out of the water and said to him, so when you thought you were drowning, what one thing went through your mind? What one thing did you want more than anything else? And the man said, gasping for breath, air, I wanted air. And Socrates said, well, when you want knowledge as much as you want air, then you'll get it. Look at verse 6 again, in terms of guiding our ambition. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. So you see, the challenge from this opening section of the sermon, this is where it lands, I believe. This is the sort of the summary verse of this first section. Jesus is saying, make your deepest longing, your default thought, your ambition, make it all drive towards righteousness. That means simply to be right in God's sight. For God to look at you and say, yes, you are right. Make that your desire. That is, says Jesus, the path to true satisfaction. So we're going to spend our time thinking about, you know, how we get that, how that's possible. Because I realize that'll be a thought that's a long way, and there'll be many distractions that will fill our mind instead of that. So a couple of points to try to get us into the sermon and to help us to land on that point, I hope. Firstly, let's set the scene a little bit, as this is the first talk in this series. Let's set the scene. Verses 1 and 2. You'll see the point there. Seeing the crowds, Jesus went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and he taught them, saying, see the first point on the handout if you want to follow that sermon outline on the back of the notice sheet. Jesus ascends the mountain and the final stage of salvation history is here. From the very start of his gospel, Matthew has carefully shown us how Jesus' life meshes very closely with, many similarities to, Moses' life. Some of those details are easily lost on us because, of course, we're not naturally familiar with Moses. Of course, for the gathered crowds, remember who Jesus was speaking to, it was familiar territory. Everybody knew and understood Moses. And so I thought I'd draw together. I mean, this is the problem with diving in at chapter 5, of course. We've missed over chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4. We have looked at them in another time, but I realize they may not be fresh and right at the tip of your tongue, so to speak, in terms of being able to immediately recall them. Let me remind you some of the details. I think there are 7 very close points that mesh with Moses, between Jesus and Moses. First, the relatively detailed description of Jesus' birth. Matthew 1 and 2 gives us some details, not the sort of details we love to go into, the sort of the gore of birth, don't we? You know, all the things that happened. Well, with some of our friends we do, perhaps. We don't get those sort of details when it comes to birth, but we do get details about the events that lead up to the birth. In short, Jesus, we get lots of details. A friend of mine puts it like this: Jesus in Matthew's gospel is a big baby story. That's unusual. Usually in the Bible, we don't get much detail of an individual's birth. But you won't be surprised to hear another big baby story, Moses. Lots of detail around the events of Moses' birth. Something so significant that the Bible writers want to draw our attention to the fact that this individual has been born, various prophecies fulfilled in that way. Secondly, straight after the birth, both Moses and Jesus were threatened with death. You'll remember, if you know the story of Moses, he was back in Egypt. At the point when Moses was born, the surrounding culture, Pharaoh's edict, all Hebrew boys should be destroyed. Matthew records an equally chilling account of the annihilation of the children in Bethlehem. All children need to be destroyed. Very similar. Thirdly, Moses and Jesus escape death at this stage. And interestingly, Moses escapes death by getting out of Egypt. Jesus escapes death by going into Egypt, Matthew tells us. Fourthly, there's periods of temptation in the wilderness. Fifthly, there's significant periods of fasting that are recorded, 40 years of deprived of food and water, or at least a huge shortage of it. In Moses' case, 40 days of fasting for Jesus. Sixthly, both Moses and Jesus cross the River Jordan at critical times in their ministry. You remember, Moses doesn't actually get to cross it, but he takes the people right up to the Jordan, and of course Jesus then does cross the Jordan significantly, going further than Moses could, to begin his ministry. And then finally, of course, the mountain. You see, we get to 5 verse 1 and we read that Jesus goes up on the mountain, and the detail may easily be lost on us, but that is a hugely significant climax. After all the points of connection that have already happened, here, Matthew says, here is the final stage, a new epoch of salvation history. It's here. Jesus is inaugurating it. Think about the significance of the teaching delivered on that mountain. For Moses, as he came to Mount Sinai, what did he deliver? The law, 10 commandments, lots of supplementary teaching. And the law, of course, formed God's people, Israel. Moses was heralded as a result as the Redeemer. He led them out of captivity. He was described as a savior. And now here is Jesus on the mountain. Not 10 commandments, but 10 Beatitudes. Beatitude, that's the title that the ESV gives it there. You'll see Beatitudes. It's a collective term for blessings. What a contrast to law. Not 10 laws, but 10 blessings. Blessed are you, blessed are you, blessed are you. And these are the words, therefore, that will form God's new people. The law formed God's old people, Israel. Here is new Israel through the 10 Beatitudes. And so as Jesus ascends the mountain, given everything that's happened so far, given all those points of connection, do you see how significant it is? It's easy for us just to overlook that. I mean, this is meant to build excitement, anticipation. And look at verse 2, you know, just when we've absorbed all of that, verse 2, Jesus opened his mouth. We're meant to be saying as readers, go on, tell us what happens. What happens next? Given all the points of connection, huge anticipation is built. Well, in Moses' day, God spoke to Moses, and he wrote, he copied everything down onto tablets. You remember, it was a very sort of confidential meeting on the top of the mountain, and Moses brought it down and said, this is what God has spoken. Well, now in Jesus' day, again, things have changed. Jesus is speaking directly to the people. Here is God's Son. And so, again, as we pull all of this together, the long-awaited King, the Messiah has come, and he is inaugurating this new kingdom, this new phase of salvation history. Moses and the law, deep awareness of sin. Sin is just our inability to meet God's standards. And the whole of the Old Testament impressed that upon the people. You can't do it, you can't do it, you can't do it, but you must try your hardest. You can't do it, you'll fail. Final word of the Old Testament, you know what the final word in the Old Testament prophet of Malachi, the final word, destruction. That's how it ends. The whole of the Old Testament, like a ticking time bomb. You'll never do it, but you've got to try. Well, what a contrast with the first word of this sermon, blessing. Here is hope. Here is a fresh start. Martin Luther, the famous reformer, he puts it like this. Now that's a fine, sweet, and friendly beginning of this teaching and preaching. For Jesus goes at it, not like Moses or a teacher of the law with commands and threats, but in the very friendliest way, with nothing but attractions and allurements and lovely promises. That brings us to the second point. As Jesus preaches this famous sermon, the challenge focuses on the attitude of heart. The challenge focuses on the attitude of heart. I think that's what the first four sentences of the sermon really achieve. Here is the kingdom's standard, if you like, in terms of our underlying attitude of heart. And I realize it raises a lot of questions. Don't worry, we will have lots of time this term to be thinking this through. It'd be a good sort of topic of conversation for us to be having with each other in church family, sort of in the sort of gaps in between everything else that we're involved in, you know, just to be thinking about the significance of the Sermon on the Mount. Well, how does it work? These 10, sometimes depending on how you divide them, it might be 9 Beatitudes or blessings. They're very short and punchy, aren't they? You get straight to the heart. We're going to be looking at it in two halves. So we'll do the first half this week. second half next week. And the first half deal with the disciples' attitude, verses 3 to 6. That's the reading we just had. And then verses 7 to 12, the disciples' conduct. So we get attitude and conduct to split the two ideas of the Beatitudes. Who is the sermon for? Well, large crowds and also disciples are mentioned. And so this seems to be teaching that is very specifically aimed at disciples. That means at Christians, but definitely with a crowd in view. The crowd are in earshot. They're the ones that are listening in. So at a very simple level, we might say, well, it's directed at the Christian, the believer, but addressing also, or relevant also, for those who are perhaps not fully on board with Christian teaching yet. And there we have a classic church today, a mixture of believers, interested observers. That'll always be the case in most congregations. So, nine times Jesus says, blessed. Nine times he repeats that word. It's all very well to say a wonderful and sort of in contrast to the law of Moses, you know, wonderful and refreshing way to start a sermon. But what does it mean to be blessed? It's one of those slightly archaic words, isn't it? We don't really talk about blessed today. Some translations get around that by using the word happy. Happy are those who, etc. I guess the problem with the word happy, I think there is some helpful sort of idea behind that. The problem is it's a very subjective feeling. Way that we use the word happy. I think it's probably better to go with a slightly different sort of thread of thinking. I've done lots of sort of work with commentaries, and there is some really helpful thinking out there. Really helpful guy called Jonathan Pennington. He describes blessing in terms of human flourishing. And I think that's really helpful. But again, I'm not sure that flourishing is really a word. We may use it slightly more than bless, but it's not really an everyday word either. I think flourishing is more a sort of language for the garden and plants rather than for us as human beings. You'll remember Ben Cooper. He spoke at our last weekend away. He did his PhD in Matthew. And I think he came up with a better sort of concept for what it means to be blessed. He said to be blessed means those who are on the best possible path in life. That's what it really means to be blessed. And I think that begins to make some sense. It certainly has some attraction because we all want to make right decisions, don't we? We want to be on a good path. And Jesus is saying, here is the secret of how to be on the best possible path in life. This is the guaranteed way that you'll always make wise decisions and always be happy and satisfied in the end. Here it is in this sermon. That's what's being said here. Those who are on the best possible path in life. I think that will probably help us understand the application, where we're going to land. So how do we sort of read it? How do we read this sermon given that? Well, in the first instance, we need to read a standard into this. There is a standard that Jesus is holding out. And I think as we absorb these ideas, we'll be thinking more then about how this will develop, this hunger and thirst for righteousness that Jesus says we should have. So let's spend a little time in verses 3, 4, and 5, and we'll think about what those statements mean, because Jesus says, you know, these are the standards that we need to be ascribing to ourselves, developing ourselves to be the people who hunger and thirst for righteousness and are truly satisfied in life, to be on the best possible path. So firstly, to be poor in spirit, to be poor in spirit. What an interesting way to start his sermon. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. It means to know and accept that you are spiritually bankrupt. What a contrast to everything that you've been taught through your education, if it was anything like mine. Education that builds self-esteem and worth and confidence. Jesus is saying all that needs to be shelved. It's not a, yes, you can do it. You can make something of yourself. It's the opposite. It's you can't. You just can't do it. You can't make these standards. Spiritual poverty stands in immediate contrast, doesn't it, to all the religions of this world. The religions of this world hold out a ladder. Climb. And Jesus says, take a knee. It's the perfect way to start this new era of salvation history. Here is a call for humility, and here is the recognition that we don't naturally do it. And so here, the confident, the rich, the beautiful, and the successful count for nothing. What a contrast to everything we naturally desire and want. Here is the great leveler. Here is the everybody can play card. That is what it means to be poor in spirit, to take a knee before Jesus. Well, let's look at the next one, verse 4. Be those who mourn. Blessed are those who mourn. And this is a really, really strong word. It doesn't just mean to cry. In the original language in Greek, there are 9 different words that express sorrow. Well, this is the most extreme word of sorrow. It's reserved only for when you sort of are mourning, quite literally, crying for somebody dear to you that has died. It's the most intense form of sorrow, and Jesus uses it here. George Whitefield preached for the first time in the open air to the Kingswood miners in Bristol. And on a later occasion, he wrote about the sermon he delivered then. It was the first time, apparently, these Bristol miners had heard the gospel explained, and they were so moved, they were so gripped by their own feeling of inadequacy. And they'd come out of the mine that day, and they were listening after work. As you can imagine, they're covered black in soot everywhere. And Whitefield writes that he could see that they were moved by the white gutters made by their tears, which plentifully fell down their black cheeks, hundreds and hundreds of them brought under deep conviction to mourn in the face of their sin. What would it mean for us to be so gripped by who we really were that it drove us to the deepest sense of sorrow? That's what Jesus says. That's the challenge here. A sense of real defilement and inadequacy before God. That, of course, it's not morbid or neurotic or unhealthy. It is natural and realistic and healthy, says Jesus. It is a right perception of who we actually are in God's sight. It's quite humbling, isn't it? And so this is the second stage, if you like, of spiritual blessing. Think about the first one, poor in spirit and then mourning. Poor in spirit means to acknowledge that there's nothing we have to offer. To mourn means to actually feel it. So we go from the acknowledgement to the feeling of it. It's what drove those miners to crying before, in the face of the gospel. They just couldn't believe how inadequate they were. I guess to put it in very simple terms, it's one thing, isn't it, to say you're sorry, and another to be really sorry and genuinely cut to the heart, remorseful, to feel it. It moves us on to the third one, the meekness in verse 5. Meekness will be the natural result of what happens after the first two. The surrounding Greek culture, of course. Now, Jesus would have primarily been speaking to Jewish people, but the Jewish people were immersed in Greek culture, and the Greeks despised the idea of meekness. It was a horrible vice. They wanted nothing to do with being meek. How interesting that Jesus says meekness is one of the attributes of the kingdom of God. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who has written and thought lots, he's a preacher from a previous time, and he writes this about meekness. The meek man is not proud of himself. He does not in any sense glory in himself. He feels there is nothing in himself of which he can boast. It also means, therefore, says Martin, that he does not assert himself. He does not make demands for his position, his privileges, his possession, his status in life. He's not always watching himself and his own interest. He is not always on the defensive. When a man becomes meek, he has finished with all of that. He no longer worries about himself and what other people say. To be meek, in other words, Lloyd-Jones concludes, to be meek, in other words, means that you have finished with yourself altogether, and you come to realize that you have no rights, no deserts at all. And you come to realize at that point that there is nobody that can harm you. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Another commentator puts it like this: meekness is not cowardice, it's not emotional flabbiness, It's not lack of conviction or complacency or timidity or the willingness to have peace at any cost. That is not meekness. It does not suggest indecisiveness or wishy-washiness or a lack of confidence. The meek person is gentle and mild of his own cause, though he may be a lion in God's cause and in defending others. Here are the standards of the kingdom, says Jesus. Imagine those words as they were sort of thought about and observed to the gathered crowd. Poor in spirit, to mourn, to be meek. What a contrast to what they must have expected or hoped in the rising Messiah that's going to take on the Roman occupation. What a contrast. This is what we've got to mull on and meditate on and think about. This develops the hunger and thirst for righteousness. That's why that's the next one. The hunger and thirst for righteousness is what comes. There is the standard. And Jesus says we need to aim for that standard. And of course, as soon as we do that, we will fail. You see, the attributes of Jesus' kingdom are impossible standards. The Christian life begins with the realization of our innate inability to meet his standards, which is so ironic, isn't it? Because here are standards that are lowly standards. They're not try very hard standards. They're try and be nothing standards. And we can't even meet try and be nothing standards because we have too high an opinion of ourselves, because we want to assert ourselves. And Jesus says, you can't even meet the nothing standards because of pride. What does that do? Well, that drives us to Jesus. The whole of the gospel account of Matthew drives us to, of course, the account of Jesus' death and resurrection. It's only because of the cross, it's only because of what Jesus goes on to do that we have any right to his kingdom. But the fact that we've been driven to a realization of our own inadequacy doesn't then let us off the hook. You see, these standards need to also be applied to our lives, not to make us members, but to challenge us as disciples and to keep us growing and maturing. This is what it means to be blessed. This is what it means to be on the best possible path in life. And here, I mean, we don't have time to look at the sort of the benefits, but the benefits are out of all proportion to anything you could ever imagine. As we put everything to one side and take a knee before Jesus, look at what he promises. Put together the promises of verse 3, verse 4, verse 5, verse 6. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Verse 4, comfort. There is the comfort that we desperately need. Verse 5, little throwaway ones, shall inherit the earth. You might put aside your ambition in the workplace, for example, for the sake of Jesus from time to time, or perhaps completely, inheriting the earth. And then, of course, verse 6, true satisfaction, the contentment that we also desperately want. Here's the underlying attitude. This is what it is that puts us on the best possible path in life. It's wonderful, isn't it? The promise to deliver, not just the material earth. Jesus says, yeah, you can have all the material earth. That'll all be yours one day, Christians. But all the comfort and satisfaction that we desperately want and all the joy of heaven, it's all yours. It's all for the taking. Take a knee before Jesus. And so I think it's a bit of an understatement to say, my friends, this is the secret to life. This is the secret to success. This is what we all desperately long for. It's not what we're distracted by, because we're distracted by all the things that we think will bring us success. But here is true success. Go back to that opening illustration. You remember Socrates putting that poor chap under the water and holding him there while he's struggling, desperate for air. Well, Jesus says we are to crave righteousness more than air itself. Key attitude that unlocks the rest, to hunger and thirst. So as we close, two things. Firstly, it must mean that we must desire above all else a righteous status for ourselves before God. We cannot be of any use to anyone, not even to ourselves, until we are right before God. We're just playing dress up until then. We need righteousness like air. But that will, of course, drive us, having been made right. It will drive us to desire this righteous status for others. And again, that's where Matthew's gospel really lands. After the death and resurrection of Jesus, what happens? Well, Jesus sends out the disciples, go and tell them everything I've told you. Go and tell the people of the world everything. And that happens as the gospel is taken out. That's how a difference is actually made in this world, as people come to know and understand who Jesus is, what Jesus did. Here is the framework to keep us going, the underlying attitude of heart. It should, of course, drive us to Jesus and keep us with Jesus and cause us to want to speak to others about Jesus. Deep satisfaction and contentment promised along the way, and the inheritance of absolutely everything that God has ever made, heaven and earth, all for the taking. This is the best possible path in life. Well, I've written down at the bottom of the sermon outline there a few questions, things that you may find useful just to sort of bring up in discussion with people over coffee in a few minutes' time. You may want to use them yourself through some quiet times, times of sort of personal prayer and reflection in the week. Just a few ideas of how you might want to use those. Why don't you just take a moment now and think about one thing to really sort of, that wants to sort of distract you a bit this week perhaps, and then I'll close in prayer in just a moment. Jesus says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Our loving Heavenly Father, please help us to be those who greatly desire more than anything else a right standing before you. May that be something that distracts us. May that be our deepest longing. May we be those who seek to really apply this to our hearts. In Jesus' name. Amen.